This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, your weekly dose of Porsche culture. With Tech Talk, Heritage, the Ren Builds playlists, along with a massive dollop of waffle, we'll keep you entertained. So subscribe now on any podcast streaming service and YouTube. Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. Welcome to episode 67. This episode is with Ninemeister. So a big company in the UK, lots of pretty great engineering work, and they produce some really stunning resto mods and their own builds. So that's coming up a little later. There's also, I'm going to talk a little bit in the intro about some of the topics that come up in that conversation with Colin that owns and founded Ninemeister. There's some stuff to discuss, so stick with that. Obviously, before we get into the main episode, though, we're going to do a bit of a review of what's been happening, what the plans are, what I've been up to for the last week or so. Absolutely no social media efforts whatsoever, so don't expect in the last week or so to see any Instagram posts or anything like that. There's loads of stuff happening in the background. Again, still trying to get stuck into the Rensporter. Sourcing parts is turning out to be a nightmare. I'm going to talk a little bit about the wheels as well. You know, with any of these builds like this, and you start doing things that are completely off book or off menu, it introduces complexity. And then some of that is down to suppliers. I used I'm not even going to mention the name yet, because I'm going to give them opportunity, or a second opportunity, to redeem themselves. But I used a wheel refurbishment company to refurb some Navis. Now, no complaints against Navis, the company. Schmoove, they're called. They're 19-inch wheels. And the idea, I think I mentioned it previously, but the idea being that they look like an aero disc, and the whole van is supposed to be inspired by the 962 Rothmans car that I, you know, saw many, many times over, and sort of spent an inordinate amount of time around at Megaphonics. Now, that's the look I wanted to go for the van wheels. And eventually, when you do see it, that's what it's going to look like. It's going to have like a creamy center, or in the 962's case, faded white, with some decals on. And then obviously that car, the 962, would have had a wheel behind it, and that was an aero disc covering it, whereas actually with the Navis wheels, it's the center part of the wheel itself, because they're a steel wheel that's been painted like an off-white to kind of signify the kind of faded, or the kind of the change and the creaminess in the white color you'd see on the aero disc of the 962. And the outer part of that wheel is painted a kind of graphite gray to kind of represent what the base wheel behind that would have looked like. Now, I've dropped those wheels off the best part of 8 weeks ago now. First effort was terrible. They argued that it was the best they could do. I'll wait and see what their final response is before I do anything else. But you could see whether they'd, you know, not clean the wheels properly. And there was bits of tape that they tried to powder coat over, and not, you know, the finish was awful. Now, I am picky. I make no apologies for being picky. And if you're a client of Rengineering in the future, I hope that you go back and listen to this and, you know, recognize that it's not a trait just for clients' cars. I apply the same level of discipline and expectation of my own cars, or even a van. You know, eventually it's a works van at the end of the day. But I'm a full paying, I paid in normal rate. There was no kind of, not even a trade discount. So I paid a full retail rate. So dropped them back after them saying, no, they're not good. They're perfectly good enough. They accepted to do them again. And I received them back a couple of days ago where they had painted or refinished three of the wheels. And they look great. In terms of the finishing and quality, I was like, yeah, you've nailed it, guys. Well done. And when the guy dropped them off, because I did request that they were dropped off rather than being collected, they had only done three. So you had, and again, any painter will tell you this, Ty at Riviera, Ty of Hello Mate, if you're listening to this, will also tell you this. Colour matching is really tricky on white. And what they've ended up doing is they've done the three, but it doesn't match the one they didn't bother to refinish. So now you've got this one odd wheel. So rather than go back and go into a loop of, you know, debate and argument over whether they're good enough, because obviously, you know, at this point they're losing out. You know, they would have done them for, you know, a third time effectively. And they've either got to get that colour match absolutely spot on, or they've got to do it all again to get them all to match. It's, you know, no skin off my nose. At the end of the day, if you're a paying client, you have an expectation that matches the statements on a website, and that's what you're expecting, right? So I will give them the opportunity for head office, who I'm dealing with now, rather than dealing directly with the franchise, to kind of redeem themselves and see what they get on with. But so, yeah, so the reason why there's not been a ton of kind of social media content, or particularly with the 911 and Porsche World magazine that came out this week as well, is I'm just trying to clear the backlog of getting all the work done that is that allows me to keep making progress. So that's why that's happened. We'll wait and see, but I am not giving up. This is not the first time I've dealt with a supplier that's not been able to reach the standard that I expect, and it won't be the last. On that though, so yeah, if you go out into, in the UK at least, and I think if you have an app called Readly, you can watch it, you can read it as well on the digital version. 911 of Porsche World published the Rengineering 981 article this month, so that's now out. I had absolutely no idea. I didn't see the copy before it went out. I didn't get a proof of any of the images. No different to anyone else. I had to just sit there and wait to see what the published article was. Now, they made a couple of mistakes, you know, which completely forgivable. They're only minor in terms of the technical specification of the car, but that's completely forgivable. What I will say is, and a huge thank you to Dan Fur. Dan, thank you again if you're listening to this. An 8-page article on the car, which is absolutely phenomenal. And the photos came out great. And some of the wording and the kind of the things they were saying about the car, particularly, which is quite interesting because I think it's probably going to be a contrast to Adam Towler and the Porsche Club Great Britain magazine that's coming out later in the year. That I think they feel quite differently about the suspension. Now, 911 of Porsche World felt that I'd absolutely nailed the suspension setup on that car, which I'm, you know, I agree with. I think it's for British roads, which I think the merits of a car, you know, should be, particularly if it's into the domestic English market, it should be based around its competency on British roads. The British A roads are a great example for that, where we've most of the time the cars get enjoyed on. And he and the guy that took it out, Steve, gave it a great shot around some kind of wobbly roads around here, right, you know, around at the point, which was actually near Boxing Gas in the sort of Oxfordshire area anyway, and came back with a rave review on it. So plus lots of other stuff. I think, and this won't be a surprise, the Gold Leaf guys, they loved the sound with, you know, with wide open throttle for the intake, the Gold Leaf performance intake system. But the same comment they applied, that they would apply to a GT4 RS. If you were to use that car every day and do 6-7 hour long journeys in it, it's probably going to get slightly wearing. You know what? Fine. The Golf Leave boys and anybody that buys a 4RS has already given that some consideration. And the Top Trumps award goes to the sound versus, you know, wanting a daily driver. If you want a daily driver, yeah, maybe not the Gold Leaf performance kit or buying a GT4 RS. For those of you that want the absolute pinnacle of oral pleasure for a 981 or a 718 with a normally aspirated engine, then the Gold Leaf performance kit's it. So yeah, 8 pages. I'm absolutely thrilled by it. Give me a shout, let me know, or stick it in the comments section of this podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever else, or throw me over and a DM or an email at the Rengineering Podcast, or you can reach me at rengineering.uk on Instagram or info@rengineering.com, and you'll get a hold of me as well. Just let me know what you think about that article. Yeah, so that's that. You know what? The interesting thing about that as well is years and years ago, I think 25 years ago now, friend of the podcast and long time friend of mine, Joe, and if you go back probably 12, maybe 15 episodes, I did a kind of live episode or live-ish episode from the Nürburgring, and it was Joe and I kind of reliving our youth together, and his Peugeot 306 that was in a Fast Car magazine. And the parallels were really funny about the shoot for my car, because the guy that was the photographer is ex-Fast Car. So I had the same, I don't know if it was exactly the same guy, but it was very funny because Joe, you know, I remember being a kid, I was probably 20 years old when Joe had his magazine feature. And I remember thinking one day I will have my car, a car in a magazine. And I was so, you know, thrilled for Joe, obviously, but you know, there was a little envy in there as well. And then, you know, fast forward, all right, it took me 25 years, but it was lovely to be able to text message him and say, WhatsApp him and say, Joe, we got it, mate. We got it. We've got a magazine feature. Now, obviously, there is big news, I mean, expected news, but big news this week in terms of Porsche. And that is to say that the order books are now closed worldwide for the 718. So that's it. If you didn't get on board and order one in the last month or so, you've got no choice now. The only cars available are going to be the ones that are already in production, already in the order line. That's it, they're gone. So we don't know exactly what the new EV model is going to look like. Everyone's seen the spy shots at this point. But the reality is, yes, it's going to be order book stuff only, or you've missed out. What that means for 981 and 718 prices, we'll wait and see. But it's definitely the end of an era, particularly for me. And for the not the vast majority, because there's lots of 911 and transaxle people that listen to this podcast and watch the YouTube channel. But yeah, it's definitely, for me anyway, I think it's bittersweet. It's been a great ride for the last, what is it now, 12 years, 13 years of seeing the kind of that generation of chassis go through the full production life cycle from the earliest, you know, late 2012 all the way through to the kind of final hurdle, which was obviously the GT4 RS. And it's amazing what they did with that chassis. It just is an absolute shame that it's coming to an end for normally aspirated or any type of 718. So one of the last things I'm going to do before I start talking about Neumeister a little bit is give a shout out. Actually, this is something I'm going to start doing on a fairly regular basis, depending on how many people get in touch. But there has been a few in the last week or so, mostly to share their appreciation of the episodes, or that they're keen to do your Porsche stories, which is still open, by the way. You can always ping me a message and you know, request to be on the podcast, and I'll have you on. If you're in the UK, then it's potentially be an in-person thing, or if you're outside of the UK, anywhere in the world, literally anywhere in the world. And I know there's people that listen in places like Antigua and Sri Lanka and you name it, there's somebody out there listening in one part of the world. So if you are a Porsche owner or you're planning to buy a Porsche, please do feel free to get in touch and you can come on my your Porsche stories. So the shout out, so I'm going to either use the Instagram at, or the name if it's an email. So at RNC_981 Rob, thank you for your comments. Rob Chamberlain sent some really, really nice messages. Matt O'Keen, Giovanni from New York, Mr. Dot Thornton, and finally Steve Burkett. Thank you so much for all of your lovely comments and questions and feedback. It's very much appreciated. Right, let's talk about Neumeister then. This so one of the things I'm going to do is give a heads up on some of the comments made. Now, with any episode that's shot, with anybody that I don't like using the phrase interview, but speak to, it's entirely up to them what they talk about. There is never, and I hope you realize this, they're all completely organic. So they go in the direction of travel that they want to. And there's no kind of, there's minimal, and I really do mean it, minimal editing. For this particular episode, there is no editing. So what you listen to is absolutely out of the can, straight into the podcast. The reason I did that, because there are some comments at the back end of the episode that you'll listen to, particularly regarding the Singer brand and Colin's interaction and influence on the start of Singer. Now, again, with all of these things, I have absolutely no idea whose version of correct it is. I'm sure Colin will stand all day by his comments around his influence on the brand. But also, I have spoken to Rob Dickinson before, as you guys will know from previous episodes. And I rate the company so highly and Rob so highly. I've got Rob's signature on the inside of the hood of my car. So that says a bit about my appreciation and respect for that brand. So just go into that, listen to that episode with that in mind, that it's the person that's talking that is representing those views, and I take no responsibility or claim any responsibility for the views of that person. They're completely separate. I guess the other thing I want to mention as well is that, and this is a tricky one, Neumeister are based in Warrington. I'm based on the south coast of the UK, and it was a 12-hour drive, basically round trip, to get to Neumeister. Colin was very hospitable, put a really lovely lunch on, and spent as much time as I needed really for me to be there, and that was greatly appreciated, and was very accommodating for anything we needed, both myself and Elliot. The sad thing, though, is that I'd spent quite a lot of time organising the availability of the car, the GT2, and the sad thing was I turned up and Colin really didn't have a clue who I was or what the purpose of the visit was. And that is a shame, because, and it's happened only once before in all of these episodes that you've listened to. Now, that isn't Colin's fault. That is one of his staff members that, unfortunately, despite me checking and saying, has he been fully briefed on the purpose of the visit and the availability of the car? Sadly, he wasn't able to do that. So I'm calling it out because it was a real disappointment, especially with the amount of time. And if you think about each one of these visits, for me, 12 hours, the cost of doing that journey, obviously, it was such a long drive that I had to stay over the night before. Paying for Elliot's time to come and help shoot with me. There's a lot of cost that goes in. And whilst, these episodes that you listen to, and I'm very much grateful for you listening to these episodes, it definitely doesn't cover the costs of those sorts of visits. So to not have the car available is a disappointment. So there it is. That's complete fact. There's nothing in there that is that's not completely backed up with evidence. That said, I will say, though, Colin was a gentleman and offered his plenty of his time and couldn't have been more hospitable, including putting a lovely lunch on as well. So I'll say thank you to Colin, and thank you to Neumeister for hosting. I do hope you enjoy this episode. I've already spoken for too long, because I think probably half an hour of an intro plus an hour and a half. But I can guarantee you will want to stick with this one, because there is a lot in it. Let me know what you think in the comments, and I'll catch you back up at the end.
There you go.
Two claps. Welcome back to the You put me off then. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to Neumeister. So I've been trying to set this up for at least a year now, and through one thing or another, it hasn't happened. But thankfully, I'm here today. And welcome to Colin Belton, the founder of Neumeister. So stay tuned. This is going to be a heritage episode. You're going to learn all about Neumeister. So thank you for joining me, Colin.
Welcome.
Yeah, what a place.
prior to sitting down and doing this, we've already done a bit of a walk around, and we've talked about designing gardens, we've talked about clients' cars, we've talked about the GT2 project and how that kind of differs and how the similarities between the original car. But before we get into any of this stuff, I want to take you all the way back to being a young boy, and your first kind of inspiration, or the first thing, that whether it was engineering and design or whether it was cars, where did it all start? What was the kind of, where's the genesis story for all this?
Well, I suppose in the 1960s, you know, most kids growing up, if you like playing with toys or whatever, you ended up with toy cars, and my first starting point, I suppose, was a Scalextric set, like most people at that kind of era. So I grew up with a passion for cars. My dad was into cars. I was always out in the garage helping him. I remember him getting me out of bed at the age of 9 to help him put a gearbox in his Ford.
Oh, nice.
So,
what Ford was it?
Funny enough, it was a
Zephyr.
A Mark IV Zodiac. Good,
was it
good
right?
Call. Yeah. It was the big bus, and he had an automatic transmission problem. So, and my mum would put me to bed, and she dragged me out of bed on a Sunday night so I could work the pivot and lever this gearbox into place. So it kind of grew up with Dad. Parents separated when I was about 11-ish. And then I just kind of went into my own little mechanical world. So I started playing with things, whether it was train sets or, like I say, Scalextrics, building model cars. But I suppose my first real experience of Porsche was, we go to tech college. I met one of my tutors, Ralph Clark, who was absolutely brilliant. And
shout out to Ralph. If you're watching this, Ralph, will you get to...
Unfortunately, Ralph passed away many years ago.
That's really, so sad. Really sad. Ralph, if you're up there or kind of wherever you are in the ether, still positive.
Absolutely. So
fond memories.
So Ralph organised a trip to the motor show. And the night before, we were just oiks, let's face it, we were just oiks in the tech college, you know, and Ralph came to me after, he said, just put a jacket on tomorrow. And why? You'll see. So we go to the motor show, and sure enough, I'm the only one wearing a shirt and tie, and everyone else is in scruffy t-shirts, jeans, and so on. So I managed to get myself onto the Porsche stand, because Ralph had a Porsche 911 Targa, an SE Targa.
Nice.
And was always going on about how great the Porsche
911s
were.
Did you drive it in? Did you see it up and stuff?
Never. No. I saw it later after his son brought it in for some work.
Right, okay.
Unfortunately, when Ralph took ill. So anyway, he took us on the stand, and I was the only one, first of all, to get on the Porsche stand, and secondly, to actually sit in a 911, and it was, ironically, it was an SE Targa. And that was it. These little things just etch in your mind.
You need the touch paper to be there. And that can be the experience of being driven in one. It can be something like that. Is there photographic evidence of this moment in time?
These are in the days pre-phones that you could walk around with, let's put it that way. Nobody took cameras. And the second one that's always highlighted to me, he's going on a fishing trip with my dad. And on the way back, he took me into a shop. We were just buying some pop or sweets or whatever on the way home. I just said, oh, can you have the magazine? And it was an auto car. And I can still visualize the cover in my head. And it was the original silver 3.0 turbo, 930 turbo. And basically they were accelerating it away from the camera lens and leaving two black lines on the road.
Yes.
And it was just an iconic shot of this big fat 911 turbo.
Yeah.
So I bought the magazine.
Right.
And that was it. That magazine really kicked off the passion for Porsche.
Wow.
So roll forward, played around with all my mates, and usual had Mark 1 and Mark 2 Escorts, Mexico's RS2000s.
You still, at this point, you're still in college doing, like, studying and stuff? And what was that course you were on? Was it a mechanics course?
H&D.
H&D, okay.
No, O&D. O&D, to be honest. H&D was the next level, but I decided to go to university.
Mm.
So I stupidly just did a degree in mechanical engineering, which was too generic, really.
Yeah, okay.
Left there, struggled to get a job. It was just a bit of a recession. Found a job as a design engineer. One thing led to another. And eventually, a mate of mine said, oh, I'm buying a Porsche. And he got himself a 911 Turbo, crazily.
Wow, you got some friends, haven't you? Like, by then, my mates were knocking around in a 1980. I had a 1983 Nova in brown.
Yeah.
With extra rust attached to the side that was being paper mache'd over.
He had an RS2000. He sold that and he bought a Dolomite Sprint that was a wreck.
Right.
And then basically, he had this scam with the coal board where he basically could get paid for driving the car all around Cheshire, because he used to go visit houses to look up flues. So he ended up scrimping, scraping, whatever, and bought an i11 turbo for 14 grand. T-Reg it was at the time. And then I thought, I want one, but I didn't want the turbo. I wanted an SA, I wanted a not naturally aspirated.
Yeah.
So bought a house, as you do, moved into it, single. And then in the first year I bought the house prices went from where they were, and they practically doubled.
Wow.
So we did an equity release on it and bought a 911.
What a boss.
Yes.
I wonder, so anyone watching or listening to this now, stick in the comments if you did something as ballsy as an equity release to buy a 911. I mean, like, I'm sure people have done similar things recently, especially during COVID, but yeah, that's a moment. That is jumping ahead a little bit though. So take me back to, obviously you've been working on the Zodiac with your old man, but
yeah.
What was your kind of entry point into owning a car? What was
first
that?
Car I ever owned, Mark II Escort Mexico.
Oh my God. You've had a blessed entry into the world of cars.
Well, I it was a funny thing, basically. So the car was $2,000, just under, 1,850 quid, I think. I'd managed to save up that. And in fact, I got a bank loan for it.
Mm.
So here was the man mass when you're 22 or something. Yeah. You know, the man mass was, I'm earning £350 a month take home. So £100 on petrol, £100 on the car loan, £100 to my mum for staying in the house, and 50 quid to spend on myself.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was the man math. It was just kind of, I won the Mexico. So it was the
what
worst.
What was the spec of the Mexico?
It was just standard Venetian red, black interior. Started playing around with it, started putting together, believe it or not, a turbo kit for it, but eventually I put a 5-speed gearbox in, and then it got stolen off my drive.
Oh, devastated.
So the car history then went something like, got rid of that, then bought a 2.8 Capri Special.
Okay.
That's an 85 B-Reg. And
in that dark blue with the red trim, or was it
Nimbus grey?
Was it grey? Okay.
Nimbus grey.
Yeah.
I actually bought one that was stolen and recovered, because in those days there was no such thing as Cat D or Cat C.
You just
bought the car and put it back together.
Yeah.
So I bought the car, put an interior back into it, drove that for years.
Right.
And then that's the one that got replaced by the 911 SC.
Wow. That's quite a very limited amount of cars to go from. And what boss cars as well.
Yeah,
rear wheel drive.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I have to say the Capri was absolutely fantastic, but as an everyday car, it's just brilliant. So, except I couldn't get in it. So the first thing I had to do was to make new seat mounts to drop the seat lower into the floor so I could get my head in it. Because I worked out that I like sitting upright in a car.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So the Escort as a rally type car suited me really well with lots of headroom. The Capri, not so much. And I've got the 911 SC, of course. Yeah, they just were what they were. They were just great.
So let's talk about the 911 then. So that, what was the spec of that?
3-litre coupe sport, red, guards red, black interior, Berber trim.
Nice.
I bought it with 50,000 miles on the clock and naively thought, it's on Bilstein suspension, I thought, right, it's great. Went out, used to thrash it around North Wales in the days before
they put cameras up,
speed cameras everywhere,
before Evo Triangle, which just kills the whole thing,
kills everything. Standard SC, and then it was kind of right. Okay, heat exchangers were shot. So bear in mind, this equity release, I got 19 grand.
That's still making me smile, by the way.
Right, I got the house cost me 30,800. I got 19 grand back on this equity release. I lent 500 quid to my brother Roy to put an engine in his Vauxhall that packed in, and with the 18.5 grand left, in fact, no, it's 20 grand, because I bought the car for 18.5, and I bought the number plate for a grand extra.
What was the number plate?
911 DHO.
Wow.
Which I've still got now.
And have you really?
It's on my 964 just in the back workshop. So I've kept that ever since. So this was in about 1988, something like that, 89. Yeah. So it cost me 19.5 grand. So the house was 30, and you get a mortgage, you get solicitors involved, you get everything.
Yeah.
The car, there's your banker's draft, and that was that.
Yeah.
It was, the irony of it was not lost on me. All the neighbours thought it was great. It was just this 911 and converted the...
How old were you at this point?
Yeah, 25, 26.
What, the mid-80s?
That's
a... great achievement, right? House owner, equity released into a 911 at mid-20s. That's really, that's like an impressive
there's a but to it, because the problem was that, okay, that became my kind of everyday car because it's all I had. And I ended up being a contract design engineer, which was really great. But whenever I went to get a new contract, I had to go borrow my dad's car, which was an old Rover. Because if you turn up in a 911, nobody give you the job.
It's an ironic thing about the UK. If you're watching this, and I've got quite a lot of American subscribers, you will, I'm sure, stick in the comments that this is true. Turn up to a job in the States with a lovely car and people immediately go, you're a successful person, you're doing very well, this must be the guy to go with. This country, for some peculiar reason, anything that says successful is deemed, well, you're obviously charging too much then. You're not getting the job. I'm going to go for the guy that turns up in a ratty kind of...
Yeah.
Which is completely illogical, but that's the way it is in this country.
You're absolutely right. The UK does not reward success. People look at it with either envy or disdain.
Yeah, bizarre,
why would you want to be that person? So the one thing I would say that I learned from a very early age is to have a thick skin.
Yeah.
So I used to be pretty large as a kid and I got bullied, but... Yeah, it kind of makes you, doesn't it? So it just isolated me from other people and made me realise that it's okay to be different.
Just be
yourself.
Yeah.
We bought.
So you're borrowing. Did you say your dad's car to go and do like quotes for things and bits and pieces?
Yeah, well, I was contract design work, and basically I just used. He had a spare Rover, so I just borrowed that SD.
Right. Okay.
SD2600.
Which is, in fact, that's right, an interesting car, because it says, doing all right.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, doing amazingly well. It says, I'm doing all right. You know, this is a nice car, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird.
So the SC kind of lasted with me for 13 years. I don't part with things easily. I don't let go of things. You know, once I made a decision to get something, it's very rare that I would actually sell it or move something on.
So what was the catalyst for moving on then? If that's
it's behind you.
Oh right, okay.
Fine. So I ended up. I had friends with turbos, and one of my mates, Dave, who bought the initial 911 turbo, decided that we want to go racing. So back in 87, 88, Porsche Club started this crazy series called the Startup Series, and it was to try and get people interested in racing, which was great, except the insanity of it was you could do it in your road car, no roll cage.
Oh, wow.
All you had to do was to put a seat and harnesses in a road car,
and that's it,
and you could do it on road tires.
Wow.
We won races in a 911 turbo with Dunlop D3s. Seriously, which were just horrendously bad road tires,
because that's
all we could afford to do.
Go by Michelin's, by the way. This we're heavily affiliated with Michelin. They're a wonderful tire brand, and I'm sure you'll get a great tire out of them.
Well, as it happens, I've got we've got the GT2 behind me.
Yeah,
I've got the 964 that's in the storage unit, and I've got my KN outside, and they've all got Michelin's.
Yeah, there you go.
So there you go. That says it all.
So you sold that car, and then you kind of started to get into a bit of racing. Had like Ninemeister as a brand been kind of twitching away in the back of your head at this point, or were you still like a privateer individual kind of?
It was an interesting one, because we started racing, and then we had Dave had a 911 turbo. We built a 911 turbo race car out of bits, bought them from a local specialist, and just put this car together. And then we basically just needed a brand to start the business off. So I packed in my engineering consultancy design work, and literally we just found a unit, put the race car in there, and we started off with a toolbox you could carry in one hand, a socket set, two axle stands, and a trolley jack.
Amazing.
Didn't even have a ramp.
Really?
And I remember the first job we got in was changing the head gaskets on a 928 S2.
Oh.
And it was like, the guy said, can you do that? Yeah. So I was going to say, yeah. I said, probably about a week and a bit. I said, why? I said, it's a 50, 60-hour job, that, you
know.
Never done one before in my life. Yeah. Owned the bonnet, it was like, okay,
there's been a number of people that are quite well known, and as a startup myself, and as trying to grow a brand and, you know, start doing some client cars and things like that, I'm always interested in people's advice. And the one thing somebody said to me is, just say yes.
Yeah.
After that, you say yes with confidence, and then figure out afterwards. And that's another great example, right, is that, what you can do, turn a client down that you're just literally starting up, you've opened your doors, and then the client goes, could you do my head gaskets or my, you know, my V8, you know, and you're just not going to say no, are you? You're just going to be like, right, well, close the door and we'll figure it out after. So yeah,
that's it, exactly. You have no choice. So I'm an engineer, a design engineer. I'm one of those fortunate people that can visualize how things work in my head. I've got a 3D CAD system in my head, and it just sort of, you look at it, you work out how it's put together, and you have to buy a few special tools to get it apart. But other than that, it was introduced me to Snap-on. That was
and then immediately switched over from like, where's my income gone? Like, 350 quid's now gone, 100 quid to your mum, 100 quid on a car. Hang on a sec, 150 quid to Snap-on.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because
not sponsored by Snap-on. Snap-on, no, if you want to do something, you can get
other, other tool brands are available. The funniest thing of all is that in that first 18 months of starting that business, my take-home pay went from circa 15 to 20 grand a year to six in 18 months.
Yeah, okay.
So that was the investment I made in starting the business, which my associates at the time were not too happy with. There was three of us trying to make a go of it. So we called ourselves 930 Sport.
Oh, okay.
And then linked on 930 Sport Porsche. And then Porsche came to us and said, you can't do that anymore. So, okay, fair enough. So we dropped back to 930 Sport. And then basically, as ever, you're naive, you're running the business. Certain people have some ideas, you have different ideas. Mm. So we split the business in two for financial reasons.
Okay.
I took a big lump of debt and started it. And I thought, I'll just call myself 930 Motorsport. It's logical. So we worked side by side for a while, didn't really work. I paid off my debt, started to invest, bought a wheel alignment machine because we were sponsoring the Porsche Speed Championship back in the day.
So still running this lean, so it's kind of, you're sponsoring stuff to grow the brand, but doing it with like...
Correct.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Okay.
So it was a 930 Motorsport back in, it would have been about 88, 89, no, a bit later on, 96, 97-ish. Mm. So I started sponsoring to get the brand about. And then the key moment really was when my business partners, 930 Sport, moved away. They moved out of the premises that, that we shared. Caused me a lot of problems. I ended up having to buy the building to carry on living there. That was about 2000. But when they moved out, I'd started a brand called 9M Racing.
Right.
So 9 was the 930.
Yeah.
M was the motorsport.
Oh, so right.
That's how the 9M brand evolved. And then when they moved away and carried on calling themselves 930 Sport, to avoid confusion and people going to the wrong place, I rebranded as 9meister.
Right. Okay.
So that's where 9meister came from.
It goes back to
the 930 motorsport.
Interesting.
So it's interesting. So the brand 9meister, as you see the yellow car in front of us. Initially, we wanted to specialise in the 964 RS and 993 RS. So at that time, I bought my 993 RS Club Sport. I started hill climbing and sprinting that with a friend of mine.
Okay.
So we branded that car. And of course, if you recognise the colour palette, it's Speed Yellow, Mint Green, Maritime Blue and Rubenstone Red.
Nice.
So all the primary RS colours of the day.
And it's this exact car as well? Its original livery, or is it kind of the livery changed over the years?
No, that's it.
Wow.
I've never changed it. It's...
very cool.
Yeah. It's a bit tired. It's a bit battered.
No, but it's like everything. I was very fortunate to be at Megaphonics recently, had the opportunity, which is ridiculous, really. They had this historic sort of exhibition of all the Group C cars. And at 10 o'clock the night before Megaphonics, I was walking around there on my own with all the Group C cars. And the thing that stood out to me and to Petrol Ped and to Joe Achilles and the rest and Pat and everyone else there at the time was the fact that the patina on the livery made those cars.
Yes.
None of those cars should ever be touched, ever. So it's ratty, and it's not even that ratty, to be fair, but the rattier, the better almost, because it shows the lived-in value of that car. You can't replicate that.
No. So I campaigned that car on in the Porsche Club Championship with that livery from 2000. Bought it in 99, I think. And then first raced it in 2000 with a mate of mine, Pete Morris. Pete Morris went on to win the Porsche Club Championship racing for many years. He sponsors that, funny enough, under PMC Midlands.
Mm.
So
shout out to Pete.
Yeah, shout out to Pete, because Pete's the one that actually organised the new roof on this building the cladding along the front and the new extension at the bottom. So
nice.
So big shout out to Pete for doing all of that.
Yeah, good man.
Top builder. So I shared it with Pete for 2 or 3 years. Then Pete decided that he wanted another car, and a 964 RS Club Sport came up for sale as well. So we both bought that together.
Right.
So we owned both cars between
right,
us.
Okay.
And in the end, Pete registered the 964. I had this in my name, and we just said, look, you keep that, I'll keep this. They're about the same value, and that was that.
Wow.
So that's how that side of the RSs came about.
And, of course, and all the while, you're kind of, I guess, by campaigning it and, you know, you're learning its quirks, its kind of the merits of the car,
yep.
the base car, the flaws, the things that actually, you know what, it's just not working, and how that would translate into a road car at that point. Had that translation kind of thought, maybe I could do something that a customer might enjoy? Or are you still like so buried in sprinting and hill climbing and...
I think more than anything else, it fueled my passion for engine design.
Oh, okay, interesting.
I've said I'm a mechanical engineer, but my passion has always been engines. So as a kid, I used to race model powerboats and two strokes.
Right, right.
Not as successful as a friend of mine, Dave, who's become multiple world champion, but I got to British champion level and did okay. But I was always interested in the engine rather than the boat and racing. It was just one of those things. So when it came to the cars, obviously a four-stroke engine is far more complicated than a two-stroke. So it was with a friend of mine, Adrian Palmer, shout out to Age. We were chatting about things, and we found a little bit of an American software package for designing engines. So we got in touch with the guy who wrote this program. It's a chap called Alan Lockheed, and he wrote this thing called Engine Expert. And it's just a DOS-based utility that gave you an insight into how to design an engine around intake velocities and exhaust velocities and port areas and so on. So I bought the program and then started playing with it. And then basically Age said, well, he's running a course at the end of the year. Why don't we go?
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
So in November 2000, we flew out to San Francisco. And the pair of us went on this course.
Yeah.
Now, of course, he was a design engineer by trade. He went into business finance in the end. So he was interested in doing a 964 RS project. He bought a 964 RS. I had this. So we flew over there. And, of course, the pair of us, compared with all the normal sort of petrol head guys who were on the course, were just at a bit of another level.
Yeah, yeah.
And Alan and the other chap that was there, Dima Elgin, Elgin Cams, brilliant, insanely talented and knowledgeable guy.
Mm.
We learnt so much off the pair of them. Came away, fired up, and then basically just started designing parts.
Wow, right. Okay.
So we built a basic...
And back then, like now, obviously, you know...
Well, no, we've done it.
Yeah, well, not only that, but like the, you know, it being able to take something, work it up in 3D space... You know, produce something that's a rapid prototype, looks a bit scruffy, but it gives you the idea of what it physically looks like and anything you might have missed, to then go into production with something that is a proper prototype, to then refine that. Like, you can do all that in a week or two now, but back in 2000, that was like a proper bit of effort.
Marathon.
Yeah.
Marathon. So the starting point really was a special engine for Adrian's 964. So we thought we'd get the best out of a stock RS engine.
Yeah, yeah.
So we used stock rods, pistons, did all the things. I remember Adrian grinding away at the rockers and making the rockers light, changed the cams, and we had a problem with cams. So eventually we put this engine together, and we had a problem with the rods because we're using stock rods, and we're trying to rev this thing at 7,500.
Mm.
And the rods just wouldn't take it. So in the end, I ended up rebuilding the engine. We fitted a 993 crank and rods, and use 993 pistons because they're 10% lighter than a 964 piston.
Okay.
So we got all the inertia out of the bottom end as we could. Lightweight flywheel. In fact, we put a super light flywheel on it. Ran it on Motec. It was one of the very first Motec conversions we ever did.
Yeah.
And we ran throttle bodies on it. I kind of remember testing it with him on the A41 20 odd years ago. And basically, I was sat in the passenger seat mapping, and he was driving it and just playing along. And right, bit more. And we realized that we're in fifth gear at 7,200 RPM.
Wow.
So you can work out the speed.
Yeah.
So it was...
Shout out to anyone that's done the maths quickly. Pause it, stick in the comments what that was.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not admitted to anything. So it was insanely quick.
Does the statute of limitations apply in the UK? I don't think it does. But
seven years.
Maybe.
Seven years, yeah. 7 years. But anyway, the point is we learnt an awful lot with that car. So it ended up with 385 horsepower at the flywheel. And was incredibly quick, yeah, and that was on throttle bodies.
And super responsive, I guess, at that
point. It was crazy fast. In the end, I remember going through a process. In the end, Adrian sold the car. The guy who bought it had us retune it. We got it perfect, and he says, great, I'll pick it up. I'm going to put aircon on it.
Yeah.
And we had to take all the throttle bodies off and change the cam and basically detune it all, because you couldn't fit aircon with the ITB set.
Right, okay.
So, but that introduced me to race engines.
Yeah.
So the next stage was to put a race engine in the 993. What we learned with Adrian's 964 is that the 964 heads have small ports.
Mm.
Relatively, they're 42 mil entry, about a 41 mil choke. Whereas the 993's got up to 43 mil ports. And then the 993 RS is a 46 mil port.
Right, okay.
And what Dima Elgin and Alan Lockheed had taught us was that smaller ports increase the intake velocity, which if you can get the mass flow through the, through a high velocity, you get something called intake inertia supercharging. So we use that effect. So I started building engines with 964 heads because they had the smallest ports. Put fractionally bigger valves in, did the math, got them working. They all made more torque. So I ended up with a 993 RS engine running a 964 head with slightly bigger valves that made 10% more torque than the 993 RS, just without any other change. So roll forward a few years, I met a few great guys who were all ex-Ilmore engineers, and they said, look, we're thinking of setting up this company. And one of them, Robin and Graham and Seb and Martin, they were all really into the cars, and they were into 911s. And I said, well, why don't we do a billet cylinder head? So that was it. The next stage really was to take what we'd learned with the 964 head and make a 993 billet head. Now, the reason why it's awkward to fit a 964 head on a 903 is just because the exhaust port bolt centres are a pair, and they're asymmetrical on the engine, so that they're both that way on the engine, whereas a 993 are symmetrical on the centre.
Right, okay.
So you need four holes in a 903 head, and that's why you can't just swap them over.
Gotcha, right.
So we designed this billet head, Graham did the port shape on it, used our experience for the choke areas and so on. Did two versions of it, second version of it in a race engine, 3.8, put an aero dyno, 430 horsepower.
Nice.
Naturally aspirated.
Yeah.
So that went into the 993 RS. We went out playing with it a bit harder on the hills, and we won the speed championship 4 years on the run.
Really? Wow.
In class one, overall.
And so, like, to become transparent, were you guys both handy drivers? Like, what was your...
Well, that was me driving it at that
point. Right, okay, right.
Yeah.
And, would you consider yourself a tasty driver? How much of it was car? How much of it was driver?
You decide, because I'll give you one example, is that we took the car to Goodwood.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never done Goodwood before in my life. So we went down for a track. Bear in mind that you know where we are in Warrington. It's to Goodwood. It's 240 miles.
I don't live far from Goodwood, and it's a bloody long way.
It's a bloody long way.
It's a 12-hour round trip.
So in a week, I drove down to Goodwood, did a track day, drove all the way back again, and then on the Friday, drove all the way down there again.
Bloody hell.
To run the car on the Saturday in the sprint.
Wow.
And there was a local chap, Tim. I'll spare his blushes and not give you his second name. There's a local guy, Tim, who had a GT3 RS. He had two of them. And one of them was a full track car prepared by Par Motorsport.
Yeah. Good guys.
So the boys at Par are no dummies.
Yeah, they're really good.
And we went out on this sprint, and it's a single lap event. And bear in mind, I've been there once.
Mm.
And you do basically four laps. You do two laps in practice, two laps overall. I came within a hair's breadth of setting FTD. And it was only on the very last run of the very last class that one of the marshals went up to a guy who was running in a Formula Ford 2000 engine and said, you know you're being beaten, don't you, by a tin top? And basically pointed to my car. And this guy tried that little bit harder, and I did an 88.9 second lap from a standing start. The single seater went out, and look, he did an 86 or an 85.
Yeah,
he was just like, I'll try.
Are they,
On slicks, and we're on road tires, of course. Tim and his GT3 RS, 94.
Wow, right.
He's a local.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
He lives on the circuit, and wow. I beat him by 5 seconds.
Wow.
So okay. So that kind of tells you about the car.
Yeah. Well, a bit of both, but yeah.
I drove it on standard Bilstein suspension.
Yeah.
And one of his mates, Steve, is a Porsche racer. Saw me driving around and basically said, what suspension have you got on it? I said, why? He said, it's on its door handles, leading around the bend. I said, it's stock.
Yeah.
And he's like, get out of it. No.
Yeah.
And the reason why I liked it soft is with the compliance, it gave you time to react.
And if you knew
the car, and this goes back, you asked the question, sorry to babble.
No, you asked the question,
am I a good driver? Well, I tend to learn things and I can get in a car and I won't be fast. My mate Pete Morris used to race. He'd get in a car and he'd be within a couple of tenths of his fastest time after 3 or 4 laps.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I would build.
Interesting.
But what I would do is analyse every single bend and work out braking points, turning points, and cornering speeds, and work out where I could go a tiny bit faster.
Right. Okay.
So I was one of those guys that just went a little bit faster everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than finding one thing that I could
do. Yeah.
So the answer to the question is, the more I drove the car, the better I understood the car.
This is more of
more confidence I got.
James Hunt versus Niki Lauda. It's kind of your Niki Lauda kind of approach.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're hill climbing, the mistake people make, and I've seen people do it, that they build cars, they have fully adjustable suspension, anti-roll bars, and so on and so on. And in truth, with 4 runs up a hill, you haven't got time to play with all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you need is a car that fits you like an old glove, where you just get in it and you know everything it's going to do and why. And that's how I got with a car. After 6-7 years of campaigning it, there was nothing that the car did that ever surprised me.
Interesting.
So just by refining it, well, I put bigger brakes on in the end because one of the things I taught Pete Morris was late braking.
Yeah.
It blew his mind because he was used to a 3.2 Carrera, and I discovered the benefits of ABS and ended up putting the 6-pot AP Racing on the front.
Mm.
The damn thing would pull 1.5G under braking. So it was just ridiculous, but knowing how to late brake, knowing how to use that and manipulate the weight transfer of the car.
Yeah, yeah.
So
especially in a 911 where it's that.
So I would have to say, from a standard car, it was incredible.
Yeah.
But the single most important modification I ever made was not the engine, not the tyres were important, sure. It was actually taking away the compliance out of the rear axle, put a stiff axle kit in the rear.
Right, okay.
Which, to be fair, is what they used on the GT2 Evos.
That's a perfect segue. So let's move out of racing and into kind of the business side again, and how you kind of transferred out of it just being like a, you know, there's obviously loads of tech development happening, but where did the, was this a, because again, having spoken to people that are predominantly racers that have created a business, it's to fund the racing. That typically is where it starts. Was that the same for you, or was there kind of a, actually I kind of need to, you know, I need a nice place to live and I want a better quality of life and all the rest of it. Or was it, I've got something I can show to customers. Where did it all start from that?
Where did it all go wrong? it's a great question. I suppose the key thing really is that I didn't like spending weekends on a race circuit.
Right, okay.
So I go away and you know, hats off to my wife Sarah for putting up with me for so long. Is that I used to just basically on a Friday disappear and then come back on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And I've been racing all weekend. And it was bad enough going away with your own car. And certain clients came to us, I'd support the hill climbing, but people said, can we build a race car? Can we go racing?
Mm.
No. Because what I found the most frustrating thing of all is going to a race circuit and watching people spend a lot of money going racing when they couldn't drive very well.
Right, okay, yeah.
And when you, the classic example, I think when we first, way back in the annals of time, we had a race car and we had a client come in who wanted to buy it off us because his local circuit, he could do this certain time, I think it was Pembrey.
Mm.
If I remember rightly, his time was about 93 seconds or something like that for the lap. And we took our car down and it did something like an 88. We were 5-6 seconds faster. So we ended up buying our car and we put his engine in, which is better. And he did the same time, he did an iron.
Oh, really?
And basically said, oh, there's something wrong with the car.
Yeah.
And he had a comfort zone that he couldn't drive past.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I was good at is pushing, is just pushing the comfort zone just a little bit, a little bit. And that reflected in the business.
Right, okay.
Because the, I think one of the secrets about business and building cars for clients is that I looked at people who I admired in the business, and I've got to say, you know, one of the first people that really caught my attention was good old Josh Sadler. I just love what he did with the RSs. I love his knowledge. You know, he's a very knowledgeable guy, affable guy. And I respected Josh right from the early days. You know, it was Josh and Auto Farm, and that was it. The second guy that really spiked my attention was Alois Roof. Guy's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a conscious decision by me that I wanted a piece of something that Alois had.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the one thing I've never, ever done is compared myself to anybody else.
Yeah.
But if you ask me, are the people in the business I admire?
Yeah.
Then yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they're the it's more the engineers behind it all. The kind of, I prefer the Ross Brawns of this world.
Yeah, yeah.
Who have got that up there and apply it in a way that is clever.
So, Gordon Murray's of this world, if you're looking outside of...
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Genius. So you asked the question, how did we get into building 9M cars?
Mm.
The first one we did was a 964 RS Club Sport, right-hand drive.
Right, right.
Because Porsche never made one.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't buy a right-hand drive Club Sport. They only made them in left. Client that we had wanted one, but couldn't buy right and dry, so we built him one. The second, we then advertised that, because he decided, because a mate of his bought a GT3 and he wanted a GT3, so we then advertised it, and a chap came up from Surrey to buy it, and it had already sold. It had already sold, ironically, to a client who, we built him a 4-litre engine based on my race car. We put it in his 964 RS, and after crashing it twice, I said to him, I think we'll put it in a car with a roll cage, because I'm a bit worried about you now, Mike. So we ended up buying that car. We put the 4-litre engine in the back of that. He didn't know, but I detuned it a little bit at the time to take some of the torque away. And he's never looked back. He just absolutely loved it. Put his RS back to standard. So this other chap, Bethel, came up to have a look at the car. Wasn't there. And we'd started building a 993 RS. R, as we were calling it. Yeah, so it was an RS Club Sport wide body. So it looked like a GT2, but with a 993 RS big spoiler. And we'd had that. We were sort of in E-coat, I think. We were just starting to paint the shell and basically said, well, if I can't buy that, can I buy this one?
Nice.
And that was it. So Bath basically was the first client to commission a build fully.
That must have felt pretty special at that point.
It was. I mean,
did you have that moment of like, well, this has got legs, were you kind of like, hey, yeah, and blasé about the whole thing? Because I know for me, the first client, onboarding of the first client, is like I've got to take this a bit seriously now, because there's expectations to meet and kind of a brand to build and the quality, like the sort of words you want people to associate with your business. Then you've got limited control over it, because once a client's driving a car and they're talking to their friends or publicising it, they're your advert.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting one, because I remember being a tiny bit sheepish when I came to presenting Bath with the final bill, because we found a genuine right-hand drive 993 RS Club Sport that had been damaged and basically involved in an RTA. And we bought the remains of the car, and unfortunately it crashed on the front right corner. It knocked the driver out because his head had banged onto the roll cage, and the fire brigade had come along and go snip, 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 and took the roof off.
Right, okay.
So we ended up with this car that just had a little bit of front end damage. Unbeknownst to us, the oil cooler had ruptured, the engine carried on running, and the engine had blown. So we ended up buying this wreck of a car, and that's what we used to build this RS Club Sport. So we're just building what it was. And it was coming towards the end of the job, and I'm thinking, this is costing a fortune. Before the days where I do everything on a spreadsheet, well, now I seem to live on them, unfortunately. So we worked out the cost of doing everything, and if I remember rightly, it was about 175 grand or something like that, the final cost. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you can buy an RS Club Sport, probably, I think at the time, for around, what was it, 2006, 2007? So they weren't fetching more than 100 grand then.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and in the back of my mind is, how can I charge that kind of money for something that's not... And you could buy a GT2, I think, for about 70 grand.
Right. Wow. So it's wild, isn't it? Like, I mean,
so,
those figures
so
are
looking
stupid,
back now, you look
you'd
at
have
it
a barn
think,
full of them.
You
know, if you could
but,
have,
but yeah. Honestly, Baff was absolutely ecstatic. He said, Colin, after taking delivery of the car, yeah, Brands Hatch, there's a famous Nine Meister video of Brands Hatch, and it's Baff driving. Well, there's two. One of them is Callum Lockie driving it. And he's the one with the, I think, bare hands. And then you've got Baff driving with the gloves on. And Callum's overtaking his mates, driving Ferraris and all sorts of things on the car, and he just absolutely loved it, wouldn't get out of it.
Right.
And that was day one. And from that point, Baff said, Colin, he said, you could have said any number and I'd have paid it. He said, I'm delighted.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that lodged in the back of my mind, saying, okay, what are we giving people? So, you know, you look behind us, there's a beautiful Nine Meister.
God, it's lovely, isn't it? Yeah.
9M64 RS lightweight. Mm-hmm. Can you buy a right-hand drive 964 RS lightweight for 200 grand? Yes. Can we build that for 200 grand? No.
Right.
So you buy a 964, which is, what, 70, 80, 90,000?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then put another 200-ish into it with plus VAT.
Yeah.
It's a 300 grand car.
Yeah.
And is somebody going to spend 300 grand on that to build that?
Yeah.
Well, yes, if you want everything brand new and you want it better than an original.
Right, okay.
Do you want four-channel ABS like we've got on this?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want a six-speed gearbox with a... do you want active, semi-active suspension? It's got Tractive on it.
Mm.
Would you do all those mods to a genuine RS?
Yeah.
No.
No.
So if you want a proper driver's car, and if you want the best of everything, and try and integrate some of the 993, 997 parts into a 964 to make it the best it can possibly be, well, that's it.
Right.
So... building cars just became a way of how can we do it better? Everyone we built, it was kind of the next one is what can we do better? What can we add? How can, and it's can we make it quieter? Can we reduce the harshness? Can we make it ride handle better, brake better?
Yeah.
Now we've come full circle.
And that's 20 years ago, right? So you're starting out.
Yeah, the first car we built in 2006, I think. Six, seven.
Coming up 20 years,
Nearly 20 years. I did a few maths the other day. I put it down on a spreadsheet and wrote down every single car we'd ever built. And I think we're now up to about 50 as a project.
That's good. I think that's good going, especially, again, I've been had the benefit of walking around and seeing some of these cars, particularly the GT2, but everything I've seen so far, and we've talked about it, again, this is not new to you, panel gaps are ridiculous. Like, Bentley would be pretty happy with those panel gaps. And that is, having been lucky enough to spend some time around lots of original cars, some restored cars, they're not all like that. So churning out 50 cars to that level is, I think that's good going.
So, ironically, if... We moved to these premises 10 years ago. So 2014 we moved. Towards the end of 14 we just about got established. The biggest mistake we ever made is moving gear and not moving the body shop at the same time.
Right, okay.
So we ended up putting the car build at the end. We got the service shop and we thought, how are we going to fill this space?
Yeah,
it was huge.
Yeah,
we come from a kind of, 8,000 square foot into 19,000 square foot. And I think, what we're going to use all the space for?
Yeah.
It's rammed.
It is rammed, yeah. Yeah.
So we've now, we've now put a 6,000 square foot extension on the side. Well, that's going to be the new build shop. We've got a mezzanine floor to put all the parts on, and then we're going to rehouse the body shop into the old build shop.
Right.
So that's the final part of the master plan, if you like, and get everybody under one roof. Now,
The paint, I have to credit you, the paint is phenomenal. You know, I know, we've talked about the painter I know, and amazingly good, and this is equally as...
Thank you.
Perfect, yeah.
Well, Wayne and Richard down at the body shop deserve an awful lot of credit. First of all, for having the faith in me to stay with us and basically except that it's taken a lot of time, basically, to get the money together to be able to get this building where we want it.
Yeah.
And start the process of rehousing them here. So all credit to them for carrying on down at the body shop. The paintwork is something that we're very, very proud about.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
And the guys, you know, originally people say to you, how long will it take to respray a car? Well, I know guys who paint a car in sort of 50 hours. Mm. I think it's a big job. Well, if you want a paint job of this level,
yeah,
stick a knot on it.
Right.
It's 500 hours.
Particularly, and a bit, again, you'll see some B-roll now, cut to B-roll. The unseen parts, and I haven't mentioned this to you, but, you know, looking at the 9/6 wall behind us, the inside of the interior that people would mostly kind of just taper for a few bits and just blast through and, you know, it's covered, it's, you know, protected against corrosion, that's enough. But you've only, you know, judge for yourselves. Judge for yourselves. Phenomenal.
It all starts in the metal. Mm. So we do all the fabrication in-house. We then, some cars get sent away for e-coat, some don't. If the car is exceptional, rot-free and perfect, we will hand strip the car down to bare metal and then paint it inside and out.
Yeah.
If for cars that have either accident damage or more corrosion, you've replaced a lot more panels, we will have those e-coated. And then start from there. But the process, when you just have a bare e-coated shell to finished, painted, ready to build, like the 964 hours.
Yeah.
500-600 hours. To assemble it.
Yeah.
500-600 hours.
Yeah.
To put an engine together, 100 hours.
Yeah.
To strip it down, probably 200 hours, because you're inspecting every single component.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then to do the fabrication work, anything from 150 to 400 hours.
It quite quickly, on a sensible hourly rate.
It's 2,000 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 2,000 hours at £100 an hour.
Yeah.
200 grand.
Yeah. So I want to pick something up right now. Everyone is an armchair expert and kind of will have their own opinion about an original car versus not just your cars, but actually lots of different companies building these things. And how can you charge X amount more for, they're just not comparable because they're a totally different thing. And it's something I've learned for the last kind of 3 years doing this. There's lots of companies out there, some exemplary and, you know, thousands of hours going into it, some less so. There's a place for everybody, but you just can't apply the critique of an original car to these things. They are a completely different product.
Correct.
And you need to approach each one of them in with its own merits and its own kind of approach to what it was designed for, who the customer is. I'm going to be driving the Cam 912 pretty soon. And I just spent some time with Mickey there, and the same sort of conversation with him is, some of these cars aren't for everybody, and that's perfectly okay.
Yep.
It's the client that goes, I know exactly what I want, I know exactly who to go to, because you'll produce what I want.
Correct.
They're not the same person that wants something that is kind of a ratty 912 or a ratty 964. They're not the same people.
No.
Sorry, I had a bit of a rant then, but it annoys me because I see lots of people kind of bitching and moaning about stuff that they, you know, are uninformed. Hopefully this podcast and lots of others will inform you into to knowing what the differences are, but yeah.
Well, I say you're cut to some of the other shots. A great example is people come to us and say, can you do me a backdate?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's some really well-known people in the business who've been doing backdates for donkey's years. I mean, Josh at Orlett Farm would have done dozens over the years. But here's the bottom line. If you want to do it properly, if you want to do it with detail, it costs 200 grand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when you come to me and say, can you do me a backdate for 150 grand? Oh, and that includes a car? Nope.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
I just can't. I wish I could. I just can't do it.
And there will be somebody that will do it.
Correct.
But the finish and the detail simply, and it's not, I wouldn't even say it's a critique of that company producing that 150K car. It's just they have to work to a budget and a margin and the amount of hours that allows to go into that. Otherwise, they wouldn't make a profit and they wouldn't be a business.
That's right.
It's as simple as that.
Okay, I'll give you a really interesting story, because everybody knows the story about Singer. What you probably won't know is that Neumeister supplied the engines for the first Singers. Okay.
Mm.
And I got a phone call from Rob and told me that he was building this car and said, look, can you do engines for me and so on? And so, yeah, I said, but I've seen your engines. Can you do me an intake system? Can you do me a throttle body set?
So
for the very first car, the orange car that they built and put on display at Laguna Seca, he contacted us and said, right, you can do this. So I put an intake system together, throttle bodies, the whole lot, put a Motec system together for him, mm-hmm. made the whole loom, everything, did it all myself.
Shipped it over to him.
And then I got a phone call. Colin, I said, how's it going? Have you got that engine running? Not quite. Any chance that you could come over next week and fit the intake system and fit the Motec and get it running on this engine? He said, it's a 3.8 we built. He said, Patrick Motorsport built it. It's a nice engine. He said, it's just a standard engine-ish. He said, all we need is it to look like one of your race engines.
Right, okay.
Sure. So, paid for the ticket, got a few tools, equipment, got my laptop and so on. Flew out to LA. His wife Tina picked me up at the airport, you know, great. Took me to the shop, and there's Rob and Tim at the shop. Walked in, not Rob Dickerson, the other shop owner. So, and basically just walked in and said, where's the car? What's that? And there was this body shell.
No!
There's a body, I kid you not, there is a body shell with suspension on it, sat on a ramp. No engine, no doors, no windows, no interior, no lights, nothing. It was just a rolling shell. Okay. So...
Was there an engine on an engine stand or a dyno?
Well, the engine was just at the side.
Right.
The engine was literally just on axle stands at the side. And it was kind of, no dyno, nothing.
Nothing, right.
So I kind of took one look at it and you were... We'll get there in there, but and said to Tina, I said, Tina, I says, where's Rob? He's just went, oh, he's busy at the moment. I says, right, can you get his butt down here like now? So he's like, why? I said, because you've got a big problem. You don't realize that. I says, you want to get that car to a show on Friday. And this was Monday afternoon. So Rob turned up and said, right, Rob, put that car together, 500 hours. To do it quickly, 400 hours. How many people have we got? Tim, Rob, me, three. I said, it doesn't compute. I said, so even if we burn midnight oil.
Yeah.
And do...
Eat, sleep and breathe, singer for the week. Yeah.
Yeah, and we can all do about 50 hours.
Yeah.
Right? So you need 8 people to build that car now.
Yeah.
And Tim, in the background, turned to his mate Rob and just went, yes.
Oh, right.
Like this. And I just said... I said, it's either that or you put me on a plane now.
Yeah.
Because you're wasting my time.
Right. Wow.
So, to his credit, him and Tim Robert phoned all their mates who were all into hot rods and cars and everything else.
Right.
Andy came over and started building the seats. The seats weren't even assembled.
Wow.
So he's putting seats together. I don't build cars for a living. But the one thing as an engineer you could do, if you see somebody doing something, you can do it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that's a little trick of mine. I don't know. So I knew how to put a windscreen in. Nobody else did.
Right.
So I'm pulling roping in windscreens because nobody else knew how to do it. Trying to show them how to put a headline in. I'd never done it before, but I'd seen my guys doing it. So I basically, I'm building doors up because nobody knew where all the right bits went in the doors and the door frames and so on. Finally came to the engine, so I'd put the intake system on the engine and got all that round and put the Motec loom in. Everything was ready to go. Couldn't run the engine until, let me think, it was the night before it was going out. So it was due on display at Laguna Seca on the Saturday, but they had a press launch on the Friday at some little outlet area in Monterey, I think. And basically... We got the engine to the point where it would run at about 10 o'clock at night, the night before. Turned the key on the Motec, fired it up, boom, balanced the throttle bodies, that was it. That was the sum total of my real job.
Yeah,
the rest of it was building the car.
Bloody hell.
We worked all the way through the night, finished the car at 6 in the morning, put it in the trailer at 7 in the morning, and me and Tim took a big, big strong drink of black coffee and set off.
Drove
to the show, and the rest is history.
Bloody hell.
Now, I told you I could talk. So the funniest thing really...
You did, yeah.
Yeah, the funniest thing is the night after the show at Laguna Seca. So we're on display, the cars on this rotisserie turntable just rotating round. Massive amounts of interest.
Yeah, yeah.
Loads of interest in this lovely orange car. Don't open the bonnet. Whatever you do, lads, do not open the bonnet because underneath it was silver and not finished. But it looked the part, and that was another lesson for me. And on the Saturday night, Rob had booked this Airbnb, which is basically a massive bungalow place, and we all got round pizzas, beers, and we're just crashing here, there, and everywhere. Yeah, there must have been about 15 or 20 of us in this bungalow. And we sat around the table, and I just said, so go on, guys, how much are you selling it for, Rob? It's going to be about 200,000. And lots of them just went, why, you're good at losing money. And he just went, no. It'd be about 200 grand plus the car. So you can't build it for that.
Mm.
And the funny thing, I apologise because I cannot remember his name, but Tina's dad, kind of, she used her inheritance off her dad to fund the project. So that's right, is how you get things going.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Rob
yeah.
had a fantastic idea, was seeing it through, but he'd spent all the money, the family yeah. money, basically.
Yeah.
So I sat down and said, has anyone got a Phil's cap, you know, A4 pad or whatever? So they come up with this line pad. And I started, literally on a piece of paper, just wrote down all the different bits and pieces that it needed, roughly how much it was going to cost. Rob's at the other end of the table. No, it won't cost that. It won't cost that. Tim, who's building the car, said, yeah, it does. So we did it all. And then I said, right, labour to put it together, to do it all, painting, all the rest of it. I said, how much are you charging? And I just said, it's got to be 100 grand. It won't cost. I said, it'll take you 1,000 hours. What's your hourly rate? So we came up, so we put it in. I said, so I just gave it to Tina. Add that up. Came to $220,000 or $230,000.
Yeah.
And then basically, Rob's in. Well, if we don't make 100 grand a car, he said, we're wasting our time because I've got to pay for all the clay modelling and everything else.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
So overnight, the car went from 250 grand to 350 grand the following day. And like I say, the rest is history. But it kind of switched Rob on to, how do you make money, and where does the money go on the car? Because he had no idea. Beautiful design, got all the details right for absolutely everything, but I had no idea when it came to how much it actually cost.
Should say, we're both huge fans of Singer, right? This isn't a Singer not bashing contest or anything. This is just
the only thing I go bashing for is that he did promise once to send me a copy of the book because he reckons I've got a mention in it, but I never got the copy.
Oh, right, okay.
So, Rob, there you go. Send me the book.
I will email you and send you a link to this episode, listen to this, and then make sure there's a book in the post.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, Greg, I love the experience. We did build them a couple of engines, one of which we built two in the UK, but they're just too expensive to do. So in the end, they ended up going to Cosworth and
Bulls, again, the rest is history.
And Ed Pink and everybody else, and the rest is there. But we helped them
set
the foundation.
Bloody hell! And I guess that then informs you in about how you kind of step forward, both in terms of design, both in terms of, you know, the art of the possible. You know, if you pull enough people together that are really talented, you can do a lot in a short amount of time, but it hurts to do it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of lessons that came out of that experience.
Yeah. My view with business, my view with cars, my view with anything, if you can imagine it, you can do it.
Mm.
It is about, you're only limited by your own dreams.
Yeah.
And there's no... don't believe anybody who ever turns around and tells you what you can't do. I'm never, ever interested in what you can't do.
Mm.
I'm only interested in what you can do.
Yeah.
And having a positive mindset and a positive attitude is where the business is. You know, 10 years ago, we moved into these premises. 10 years ago, I saw the frontage that we've got now and the windows and the extension at the bottom. And what frustrates me in business is that I've had that image in my head for 10 years and Pete's turned it into reality.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing of all for me is people say, oh, it's fantastic, isn't it? I just went, yeah. And they say, you're not like, no, because I've seen it for 10 years.
So if
it comes to a car like this,
yeah.
I sit down with a client and we work out a spec on a GT3, like red one at the back or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as I've sat down and start writing down the spec on, I don't say it, spreadsheet again, I can see the car. The car is finished here. I know what it'll do, I know how it'll drive, I know it'll run.
It's fascinating because it's the same for me. So we'll talk a bit about the REM 550 off camera because I've bored everybody to tears on the podcast now about what it is. But this is a Lotus M111 chassis 550 Spider in carbon fiber. The whole thing's carbon fiber because the chassis is stiff enough on its own, mm-hmm. with an air-cooled engine in the back. So it's nice. Tiny little skinny tires. You know, it's not supposed to be heavily sprung. It's supposed to just feel light and, you know, twitchy and relatively low powered. I can see that finished.
Yes.
It doesn't exist and I can already see it.
Yeah.
And it's trans for me as a startup trying to move from seeing it to building it like this, you know, and hopefully in 10 or 15 years time, there'll be some cocky upstart sitting, and I'll be sitting in your seat and they'll be asking me these questions and I'll be like, you just got to believe.
Yeah.
You've got to chase it.
Yeah. Yeah. We should all watch Ted Lasso.
Yeah. Yes. Let's watch Ted Lasso. We've done a lot of the kind of history and the genesis and getting to where we are. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and we'll do a walk around and talk properly about the GT2. So welcome back. I don't know where to start with this thing. I mean, firstly, it's beautiful, but
thank you.
We should summarize what this car is. So for the viewers watching this, can you give me a quick synopsis of what you've created?
The name for it that we put on it is a 9M93 GT2.
Okay.
Simple. So, looks like a GT2, goes like a GT2. Underneath it all, it's our version of a GT2.
Yeah.
So we all know the icon. It's the most radical Porsche ever made with an air-cooled engine. 430 horsepower as standard, and two-wheel drive. This is all of that and a little bit more. So it would be easy just to take a turbo and put arches on it, paint it a lurid color and say it's a GT2.
Yeah.
But this isn't. This is right down to the body shell. An exact factory recreation of the car with a little bit more besides.
So does a client turn up and say, here's my car, use this as a base, or do you go out and source a car for the client, or is it one or the both, or?
Typically, we would expect the client to supply the car. Now, usually, it's because we're building cars for a client over or in either USA or Europe or Far East, and because of import restrictions, it's a lot easier to start with, for example, a Japanese car that's come from Japan to go back to Japan or Australia or America. Or in a couple of cases we've got a car that's been built for a chap in Slovenia. So they get the car, they register it in Slovenia, they then ship it to us for the work, and then when it goes back in,
perfect.
There is no issue with import.
Cool.
So the difficulty is if you buy a 993 Turbo, which is the perfect donor car for the GT2, if we build it as a GT2 and you try and take it back in, then they'll try and register it as a GT2.
Yeah.
And they'll look at GT2 values, and we've got one in here now, which is worth £2 million. So they'll want the tax on it at £2 million.
Right.
So if you start with the turbo, which is typically 150, maybe 200,000 euros, register it in your own country, bring it over, we then do the build, take it back. So whilst duties are payable on the work, not on the car, because the car's already registered.
Perfect.
So it kind of mitigates any future problems.
So in terms of detail then, how much is factory, now that Porsche have tooled back up again with historic panels and stuff, and how much of it is, you know, in-house custom work and kind of, you know, rolling and English wheeling and things like that? Is it, how much of it's?
Well, in general, we try to use as many original Porsche parts as possible.
Yeah.
We're not building a custom car, we are restoring and building a car which is as faithful to the Porsche brand as you possibly can be.
Yeah.
We put our interpretation on it, and really it's the engineering under the car that we change rather than the outside.
Right, okay.
So
what, talk me through some of that engineering then. What would you point out as kind of the things that are, you know, the uniqueness that you apply to your design work and kind of the finished product?
Down to clients' interpretations and what they want, because Let's go to the obvious place. We probably start at the back and start with
start
with the engine. So down here, what options have you got? Well, the starting point, twin turbo, 993 turbo engine, 408 horsepower straight out of the box.
Yeah.
What's the difference with the GT2? Has K24 turbos around the K16, slightly bigger turbos, and different map, that will make about 430 horsepower.
Right, okay.
But do they? And the answer to that is no. Most turbos, if you tune them correctly, will run up to the limit of fuel flow of the standard injectors, which takes you up to about 490 to 500 horsepower-ish. So for most cars, tweak the boost a little tiny bit, different turbos, take the silencers off, as this one, maybe 200 cell cats, you're going to hit somewhere close to that 400 horsepower level.
Right, okay.
So on paper, if you want to use as many factory parts as you possibly can, you can build this engine up to 400 brake.
Right, okay, perfect.
Now, torque-wise, it's an interesting one, because if you put bigger K24 turbos on, the problem is, yes, they give you more airflow, they give you more power. The next stage is, they also give you huge lag.
Mm.
So it is a lot more noticeable when you put a bigger turbo on a twin like this, because the engine's got to work harder to generate the same boost. So the torque curve tends to be a huge spike. So the next stage is, well, what can we do about that? And that's where the Neumeisterisms come in, which is, what can we do? Well, one of the latest generations we're building is using the 997 VGT turbos.
Yes.
Variable geometry.
Yeah.
So you think, well, okay, let's put VGTs on. But the standard ECU won't run them. What's the best ECU can run? Well, we've chosen Life Racing.
Right, okay.
So, which is a Le Mans proven and tested engine management system. And we're currently engineering a new 993 turbo engine with VGTs, with the Life Racing ECU. And we've used that same system on a 964 that we've developed as well. So we've taken a 3.6 turbo, we put the same system on, we've converted that to drive-by-wire. That one made 800 newton meters of torque, 560 horsepower.
That's on site as well. We'll grab some B-roll and stick that
inside. Yeah, I mean, it's a stunning car. That's the second version of that. We built a black one for a client in Belgium. UK client came in, saw it, and said, I want one of those, please.
Mm.
And he's chosen blue, so we built him one exactly the same. So we're now getting to the stage where we're looking at reviewing engines and reviewing the design work and say, well, okay, are there better components that we can use enhance what's already there? What we're not trying to do is we don't want to give it 1,000 horsepower. It's pointless.
Yeah.
What we do want to do is enhance the driving experience. And if we can spread the torque and make it much more drivable, you're going to end up with a better car.
Yeah.
So engine, perfect case in point. Gearboxes, the 993 turbo gearbox, great gearbox, but we convert it to two-wheel drive. It's a simple conversion, everybody does it. Do we leave it there? Well, no, because the next option is we can actually put a GT2 oil pump on there.
Okay.
And put oil spray on it, so that if you're going to run 850 newton meters of torque, you want to look after your gearbox.
Yeah, sure.
Now, on the factory GT2s, they use hardened gears, which were tougher than the original ones. We don't have that option. Porsche don't sell them anymore. So whilst we could refinish some of the existing gears, the choice really is, well, okay, well, let's just cool the gears better with an oil cooler system, oil cooler up front. So transmission-wise, everything pretty much sort of like works itself out. Two-wheel drive, straightforward enough. You then get to the chassis. How can we enhance the chassis?
Yeah.
So you've got kind of two options, really. One is to go down a passive route, which is basically to put much better shock absorbers on. Or indeed, you can just go down the factory route and say, okay, we'll just run all 993 RS GT2 suspension, which is what Porsche did with the Turbo S. Great philosophy. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
If you're just
looking for a beautiful road car with perfect factory manners, just fit the factory suspension.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. If you want to go a little bit more, as some clients do, we can put the Tractive system on, which is in-car adjustable, or we'll go to another level now, which we'll be using on the 9M64 RSR development car. And another car that we're doing now, we're putting an MCS four-way adjustable system on there. to really try and get the damping perfectly tuned to the car.
Yeah.
So that's something that we're on with now. Factory top mounts, factory RSR hubs, factory brakes. Then you come to the braking system now. The turbo and the RS, the 903 RS, are the only cars that Porsche built with four-channel ABS.
Mm.
So, again, it works and it's great. Now, if you were tracking this, you would probably replace the ABS ECU with one off a cup car.
Right, okay. Because
there are known track issues with the 993 RS ABS. However, if we're building one of these, if we're building an RS out of a standard 993, they come with three-channel systems. So we adapt them. We put a four-channel system in off a 997.
Right, okay.
So use the two-wheel drive 997 system. It's a Bosch 5.3 ABS system. Fantastic system. So go as late as you can. And again, engineer the car to use more modern components.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So great. So we've talked about the engine. We've talked about transmission. We've talked about suspension, brakes. What's the next thing? Interior.
Yeah. Yeah, let's have a look at the interior, because it's beautiful, isn't it?
So again, again, the philosophy for me is, it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'm not going to fill the interior full of aluminium. It just looks kind of tasteless. So what we've got here is our highlights are really exactly as Porsche would do with the 993 RS. So we're using original RS door handles, panels, gear knob, and so on. The tweak with this car is that we've got an Alcantara dash top.
So the
Alcantara gives it a lovely
texture. People don't appreciate how much of a difference that makes. Just changing textures from one to another is amazing.
And we've used Alcantara on the headlining as well.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, the interior, especially from a client's perspective, is the most important part of the car.
Yeah.
So we all know what it looks like and so on. But when you sit in the car, the seat has to fit you, it has to suit you, has to smell right, but it's the touch, because your fingers are ridiculously sensitive. Mm. So having the steering wheel retrimmed in leather, perfect. Gear lever, perfect. Anything that you touch needs to be absolutely spot on.
Lovely.
So the seats, we mentioned the seats there. The 993 RS, 964 RS seats, no longer available.
Mm, mm.
So the choice is, you're building one of these, you want an RS seat.
Yeah.
You can fit pole positions, you can fit SPGs. SPGs are too small.
Yeah.
If you're anything like my size.
I mean, I'm all right with an SPG, but yeah, most people aren't.
Well, have a sit in this one.
Yeah.
So this is our version of the factory RS seat.
Oh.
It's a fraction bigger than the SPG.
Yeah.
But it's nowhere near as big as the extra large.
Yeah.
But the difference is, these seats are made out of carbon, so they're lighter than the original factory seats, and we've also had them sled tested. So they, again, big up Reverie, who did all the development and design work for us on the seat to get all the testing done, and of course they're FIA approved. So what we're doing there is fitting a new version of an RS seat made in more modern, lighter material, stronger, but it echoes the original RS.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, the only reason why we're making them is because you can't buy them.
Yeah.
Secondly, we've got billet side brackets. The billet side brackets are part of the FIA approval.
Mm.
The original ones are made out of folded aluminium, which I've never really liked. So we've done these out of billet. They're lighter than the folded aluminium ones and stronger.
Yeah.
So again, flew through sled testing.
Nice.
So this car features a lightweight interior. It's got carpet set in the back. But underneath all of that is sound deadening, which was not normally fitted to a lightweight.
Yeah.
But we're finding more modern cars tend to be much better in NVH, noise, vibration, harshness.
Yeah.
And we find that clients don't really want the rawness of an old school 911 sounding like a tin box. So we go to town a little bit with sound deadening to bring modern standards into an older car.
Perfect.
So we still like them noisy.
And I notice you've got the PCCM as well. So it's kind of a modern, again, it's Porsche factory products.
Yes.
Allows you to integrate CarPlay, I think, and things like that as well.
It does,
so
yeah.
just modern amenities and a kind of classic, classic silhouette.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Absolutely. Really nice.
It's a great head unit.
Talk to me about the. So this is a client's car. So
this is my car.
This is your car, right? There you go. So talk to me about the paint then, because I mean we talked about how nice the paint finish is, but what attracted you to the colour particularly? This.
Well, the car started out life as a turbo, and we had a great idea with two of my other friends, Robin and Mark. Mark incidentally owns the 964 Maritime Blue one that we built for him. And we came up with this plan to build a car. And we said, well, what have we got? We've got all these bits. Mm. What can we build? And we just said, well, let's build a GT2. So we started off, and there was three of us in this process. And the original donor car for this was Iris Blue. And we didn't want to use a metallic blue. We wanted a Porsche RS colour.
Yeah, yeah.
So we flipped between doing it Riviera Blue Maritime Blue. And we thought about all the colours. But in the end, because the original car was blue, we thought, it's got to be blue.
Mm.
But my problem is that if I build, let's say I did this in Nagaro blue, there is one. If I did it in Riviera blue, there is one.
Fine.
So we had to pick a colour that echoed the Porsche fleet, but wasn't obviously GT2. So that I don't want to drive a car around and people say, oh, it's just a replica. It's
not. It has
to stand out.
Yeah.
So the colour we actually picked is a Porsche colour off the 2011 Speedster.
Oh, okay, right.
So the 997 Speedster, when it came out, was the launch colour was this, which is pure blue.
Pure blue.
So 2011, 2000, the 997 Speedster.
Lovely.
So that's where it came from. I thought it looks right. You compare it with the Maritime in the background, which has got that hint of lilac and red in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an iconic 964 colour. And then we thought about Riviera. Well, there are Riviera cars, and they're just that little bit light for me. It's a pastel colour, a bit too much white.
Mm.
This, for me, has that touch of green. It's not quite blue turquoise, which is a gorgeous colour again. We could have picked that. It's just of the palette, but not quite the same.
Perfect.
So that's how we ended up with the colour.
Perfect. So if a client's looking to commission one of these, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, they walk through my door. they walk through my door, look at the car, and like, can I have one of those, please?
Right.
And it's as simple as that.
Yeah, okay.
And that happens.
Right.
Ironically, okay. That happens. We did have one. We built a 9M11S for a client and basically ended up selling it. And the chap who bought it, well, loved it so much and then said, oh, I really just fancy a turbo or a GT2. So, well, come down. So we had this car in the showroom and the shell of a Guards Red one that we're currently assembling. And I said, what colour do you want, Bob? And he said, Guards Red. So he brought his wife. So this is on one side, the Guards Red one is on the other. And Bob basically walks in and says, yeah, I love that, but I want it this colour. And his wife says, I love that, but I want it this colour.
Oh, wow, right. So guess the answer is.
So guess who won?
The wife, obviously.
Yeah, so basically, here's one we made earlier.
Right.
He's commissioned a right-hand drive. His specification is comfort. So we're doing comfort seats, comfort interior, standard suspension, standard engine, but it's still a full two-wheel drive GT2.
Perfect.
Be driving out of here before the end of the year looking identical to this.
Lovely. Let us know in the comments if you've got any questions for Colin and for Ninemeister. But I hope you've enjoyed this walk around of this GT2. It's a phenomenal piece of kit. I just want to take it home, really. So you see what I mean, okay? yes, I don't know what to say about that. At the end, you know, I'm not a clickbait guy. I want the Rengineering podcast and the brand to be wholly positive. You know, I will avoid either interacting with companies that I don't particularly feel an affinity for, and those that I do, I'll stand by the commitment I make to spending time with them and try and represent them as best I can. So fair and unbiased, and that's what the episode is, and you get to hear it as you will. Or if you have even. So I hope you enjoyed it. Yeah, give me your feedback and let me know what you think about the episode as an entirety. And you can, as I said, you can do that through either email info@rengineering.com or through Instagram's best. I don't use Facebook particularly at all. So, and I definitely don't use X.
nobody needs that crap in their life, do they? So at the Rengineering Podcast or at rengineering.uk. This weekend, quiet one for me, other than the fact that I've got to go collecting more parts of the van. And then we are on the countdown, I think it's 2 weeks until the Niners Unplugged Live episode. Just been literally messaging Frank in the last few minutes, doing some planning for that. So that's going to be really exciting. I'm very looking forward to meeting a lot of people there as well that I may not have met before. And I hope if you're coming, you're going to really enjoy it as well. The first of those Niners Live episodes. So let's see how that goes. Thanks ever so much for listening. I really appreciate your time, and I'll speak to you very soon. Next week, it will be a Gold Leaf performance episode, so stay tuned for that. Take care for now. Bye-bye.